it is my great pleasure to welcome Eleanor Kibrick. Eleanor has spent 10 years teaching physiology to undergraduate and graduate nurses in Canada. And she then served as the co-director for Special Services Center in Arlington, Virginia. Their clients included the Smithsonian Institute, Penn State University, and the Institute of Cultural Affairs. Based on several years of training, Eleanor went on to design and lead workshops on providing communication and facilitation methods for groups and individuals. And she has co-created a program for nurses and other health professionals called Care for the Caregiver. And she has done that with her esteemed colleague, Diva Marie Beck, who we've also had the pleasure of interviewing on this show. Eleanor, it's so good to have you. Welcome.
Thank you. I really feel good being here.
Well, I am just delighted that you could take the time to speak with us again, because we have had the pleasure of speaking before, but unfortunately we did not get it so that we could put it up on the archives and have everyone else hear about the extraordinary work that you're doing with communication and with language and with care for the caregivers. So let's start at the beginning. Let's talk about how all of this began with your early work teaching in Canada, and then let's bring the audience up to speed on the work that you're doing today.
Well, my background really is in having degrees in physiology and pharmacology, and I found that most of the people that I taught really in terms of health professionals were nurses, and so I got introduced that way to nurses, their situation, their point of view, and so on, and it was just a wonderful, wonderful time that I spent with them. And then came from Canada to the Washington, D.C. area, and with some colleagues, we were consultants here. I mean, everyone in D.C. seems to be a consultant of some kind, and so are we. And we facilitate group processes and so on in different institutions, and spent a lot of time actually at the Smithsonian helping build creative planning for them and so on. And then I was studying for a number of years with a group of people under a system called Mastery Systems, and that really called to me very strongly, because it taught me basically how to be responsible for my thoughts, my words, how to keep my internal dialogue down to a minimum of clatter and static and negativity, and really stay focused, positive, and clear. And these tools have been so valuable to me that I've created different trainings to bring them to, at first, the general public, and then to the nursing community.
Well, I know from speaking to others about your work that it makes such a difference to become aware of words and communication and intentionality and how we are verbally and nonverbally dialoguing with one another. So we're going to get to that soon, but I would love for you to talk about your travel throughout Europe and India and how you met your husband in Canada and all of those other wonderful things.
Well, in 1983, I was living in Toronto, and I volunteered to help an organization put on their conference, and it was called Planetary Initiative for the World We Choose, and that's where I met my husband and other people who were working there, and together we formed a volunteer team and spent a number of months in Brussels, first of all, doing a lot of logistical work and setting up seminars and symposia for the NGOs in Geneva and in Brussels to make them aware of a big exposition of rural development that was to be taking place in India in early 84. And so then we were in India for several months, again, getting ready for this amazing international event that highlighted people from the grassroots were selected as doing the best projects in their country based on a lot of different criteria, rural development projects. And they were ones that empowered women, that had good economic results, that, you know, were repeatable and so on. And it was a major turning point in my life, because I really felt that I was truly a global citizen and had a kind of panorama of the world's peoples in front of me, because people came from about 55 nations. And it was the only conference I've ever been at where most of the people were actually the workers who came from the variety of places, and only 15% of the people there were from World Health, UNESCO, UNICEF, all that kind of thing. So it was a big eye-opener for them, too, to see how alive and functional people were at the grassroots level.
Well, I'm sure that that was a very astounding experience, given that usually we do not see people who are coming from the grassroots. And what a wonderful gathering, as it were. Now, after you were doing all this wonderful traveling and what have you, you came back to D.C.
Mm-hmm.
and began the mastery programs. Do you want to talk about those?
Well, when we came back to D.C. first, as I said, we started actually a for-profit, which was Special Services Center, and a non-profit called Earth Training Systems, where we trained environmental groups to have the skills and tools to be effective at the county level, where things actually get done. And that was a wonderful experience. And then I took courses in mastery systems, first in Annapolis and then in Florida, and they kept moving around. They're now located in North Carolina, to learn a bunch of a variety of facilitation skills, first self-facilitation and then facilitating of others, to really become cognizant of the power that our thoughts and language have both on our own well-being and our own energy, as well as how we affect others in our lives. And also I became certified in something called outcome facilitation, where it's another way of doing strategic planning, but in a much more powerful, visceral way of being kind of at the end result at the beginning and then looking back to see how we got here. And it's a very effective way of really moving quickly into creating what it is that you intend to create. It's
well,
a very strong technology.
I remember in our previous conversation you were talking about how you started consulting to offer tools for personal growth and awareness of the internal process. And I wrote a quote down, language and belief systems inform our life. And that's that was your quote. And would love to have you talk a little bit more about how you moved out into the consulting realm to do these personal growth and awareness processes, because you had said that you took a lot of the training that you had, but you actually added a new spin on it. You began to include or add or change some of the things that you had learned and really brought it up to speed so that it started to speak to us in a different way.
Well, I'm a very pragmatic person, and I really believe in teaching things that are immediately useful. And what I have found is that one very strong way to illustrate the fact, I mean, we can talk about, yes, you know, thoughts have power and so on, and it's very important to illustrate it viscerally so people really get that it really does have power. This is not a theoretical discussion, and so I'll give you an example. Last summer, Diva and Peggy and I worked with a group of 200 nurse managers and hospital directors in Memphis at Memphis Methodist Healthcare System for a half day of their two-day senior staff retreat. And so we had 200 people in this huge room muscle testing each other for words and thoughts and the power that they have. So they were astounded because, again, you know, they hadn't had this personal experience. And so we had people, first of all, feeling language in their body. How does it feel in your heart area, in your belly area, when you say, I can't, I should, I won't, etc.? How does it feel in your body energetically? Does it feel different from saying, I will, I love, I enjoy, and so on? And then we had them partner up and taught them the basics of kinesiology or muscle testing. And we had them, you know, say these words quietly or to themselves and see if their strength, what increased their strength and what diminished their energy. And it was astounding because it really is very apparent when they were doing it that words have power. And then we had them think and not talk about what they were thinking. They could think of a situation in the past where they were sad or upset or lonely, or a situation where they were happy, successful, and so on, and not tell the person testing them which one they were thinking about. And certainly, I mean, 100% of the time, the happy thoughts were strengthening, and the depleting stories or the stories of sadness or, you know, where things didn't work out well, were de-energizing in terms of the physical system. And it was astonishing to them. And they were, it was amazing. I mean, they were laughing, they were carrying on, they were you know, receiving this in an astonished way. And that was wonderful because of what they could take back to six hospitals now in terms of being aware that when you walk into a room and you're thinking thoughts of anger, negativity of any kind, people are affected in that field. And you yourself are weakened by it. So it's important to understand that that's where care begins. It begins internally.
That's such an important thing that you're bringing out, and the work that you're doing is so wonderful. And it's confirmed by, actually, there was a Harvard study that was done on something called the Mother Teresa effect. And they exposed 132 Harvard College students to watching and listening to the work of Mother Teresa. And they took immunoglobulin A readings prior to watching it and immunoglobulin A readings after. Now, whether or not the students agreed with her or her politics, her life, her faith, or any of that, by being exposed to the words, by being exposed to the visual awareness, and taking in just the intentionality, their immune system actually increased in their activity. They also exposed the same students to a movie about the Third Reich, and there was no improvement, no increase in the immunoglobulin A activity. So the work that you're doing is so wonderful that you're bringing this very important awareness of how we use ourselves as therapeutic presence, how we are able to be or not be therapeutically present to one another in our intention and in our language. And what a powerful and wonderful and beautiful gift this is, and what a wonderful way to remember who we are, what we want to do, and what we want to give and experience ourselves in caregiving. So it's just very interesting, wonderful, and important work for people to know about. Eleanor, we're going to, believe it or not, the first segment has gone by. We're going to take a very short break. When we come back, would love for you to talk about something that we discussed in our first conversation. You brought up the three questions and the need for us to ask the three questions, especially as caregivers. We need to ask, you know, what am I doing here? What's the purpose of my work? So when we come back, if we can bring your wonderful language work into the realm of the bigger context of our life, the overview of our life, we can talk about that and continue this great conversation. So don't go away, everybody. We'll be right back.
This is Richard Tyson. Most people think of the Shriners as a fun organization, but they have a serious side too. How do I know? Well, I'm a Shriner. Shriners Hospitals provide kids with expert medical care totally free of charge. And they combine orthopedic and burn care with progressive research and innovative teaching programs. There's a Shriners Hospital helping kids from this area. For more information, call 1-800-237-5055. Shriners, giving help and hope to kids for over 80 years.
And we are back at Celebrating Whole Health. We're talking to Eleanor Kibrick, who has spent many years working with language and communication and helping so many nurses and other caregivers to become more aware of the power of their own therapeutic self. Eleanor, before the break, we were talking about this extraordinary work that you're doing. And please share with us the overview of what does it mean for us to become aware of the language that we're using and how we are using ourselves therapeutically.
Well, I will, and I just want to put out that in, and after that, I'll be giving a concrete example so it'll illustrate what I'm talking about. What I was saying is that to really do our work as caregivers, first of all, we need to be caring of ourselves, and also know that the energy we take with us into any situation is paramount in terms of the kind of effect that we'll have on others, because we are the instruments of caring. I mean, we embody caring, and to embody caring, we need to walk our talk on all levels. We need to care for ourselves, care for one another in support of each other, and certainly care for our patients. It starts internally, and that is the message that is really what we bring out into the world. And it's nonverbal, it's under the surface, and people feel it when we walk into a room.
You said something during the break. You said we use ourselves as the instrument.
We are the instrument.
Yes.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely.
And that is, I think that's such an important thing for all of us to realize. But again,
we don't give healing. We are healers. It's a very different energy.
Yes, yes.
I mean, at our best.
Yes.
We all have our days. But really, we embody being, at best, we embody being a healing presence.
And what is a healing presence? That's the question. And what you're bringing up is what a healing presence is. And it is being mindful and authentically aware and creating the intentionality that is to bring life, to uplift life, and to celebrate and support life.
And to come with a compassionate heart for ourselves as well as for others.
Absolutely. Now, we've got to go back to the three questions because we did say we were going to talk about that. Would you, I wrote, you know, the first time I spoke to you, I was so impressed with our discussion, and it was just so inspiring. I wrote almost everything you said down, and one of the things that really hit me was the discussion about looking very mindfully at our own lives and asking the three questions, which, you know, you are hopefully going to discuss for us.
Well, give me the first one.
Well, why am I here? What is the meaning of my life? And where do I go when I die? Yes.
Who am I and why am I here, so to speak? Well, you know, taking it in the context of what I'm helping people with, one of the things to tease out to help people understand is that all of us operate on certain assumptions and belief systems that we learned a long time ago, and it's almost like in our very ground of being. And many of these assumptions and belief systems are not life-affirming ones that we've soaked in about aging, about women, about whatever. And so as we can tease out what belief systems are not serving us, we realize that who I am is much greater than my belief systems, my ideas, my opinions, what I ate this morning. Who I am is a spirit being here in a body form, learning how to be a human being and be in my heart. And so a lot of people get confused in terms of their identity by identifying themselves with their belief systems, ideas, and thoughts. And those come and go at a very rapid pace and aren't really who we are.
Yes, and so often we really do interpret all of those messages as who we are, our personality.
Yeah, and when I do a lot of personal coaching of people as well as doing work in groups, and to get to a point of people understanding that I am not that thought, I am not that belief system, I am not that assumption. I am a great being here to do creator's work and give my gifts to the world. It's a very different place to come from.
I want to share with you and the audience some work that I'm sure you are very familiar with that I think ties into what we're talking about. So much of those messages are tribal messages. So much of those messages are really unconscious, shall we say, inheritance that we get, that get passed on to us, that we receive from our backgrounds, that, you know, well, I'm not smart enough, or we're not good enough, or I can't be that, or I have to work and I have to, you know, I'm not allowed to have happiness. There are so many subliminal messages that come to us through our environment and through our backgrounds of where we come from. It becomes very challenging to take a look at how we are inculcated to not know ourselves and not possess our true self. There's almost a prohibition against it in the way that that we live today. And I would love to hear your comments about that and how it affects our language.
Well, I mean, a lot of people think they are their job description. And that's not who they are. It happens to be what they're doing at the moment, really. And a lot of people identify with what they have, as though their possessions define them, and their certain brand, their certain brand of car that they drive or neighborhood that they live in reflects upon them, when that is not the essence of who they are. So it's important to take all that externalization that people are acculturated to think of as proof of me being important, and release it. And a lot of people, that's where the fear comes in of going, well, if I didn't have this to identify myself with, I don't know who I am. Who am I? And that's a big question. And getting to our core of being is a lifelong journey of shedding a lot of the externally derived definitions that aren't really describing the essence of who we are at all.
And a lot of that, doesn't a lot of that develop out of words, words that are said, words that are not said, words that are thought, words that are implied. So I think what you're offering is a powerful tool to begin to transform the process so that we can begin to move out of some of these old dialogues, these old communications that we get stuck in and that gets stuck in us. And so we can begin to unfold this wonderful process of self-discovery. Would you share some of the stories with us? You said you wanted to give us an example.
Well, I mean, the first basic thing is to monitor our internal dialogue. I mean, we're always busy talking to ourselves within ourselves. What are we saying to ourselves? A lot of people don't pay attention to that. It's kind of like an underground current that can be very depleting. And as you said, it could be I'm not good enough, she doesn't like me, why did they look at me that way? You know, this constant internal chatter that goes on. Once we become aware of our inner dialogue and monitor it, that's when we can use it to radically change our lives. One example that's current is I'm currently coaching a therapist who lives in another state, because I do a lot of coaching over the phone. And she, when I started working with her a few months ago, she's very, very nervous, very high-strung, wonderful woman, and I'm sure a good therapist, and still needed, you know, very agitated type. So needed sleeping pills, needed antidepressants, needed all kinds of things to keep her functional. And we started working together, and after a couple of sessions, just it doesn't take long, which is so amazing. She phoned me and said, you know, I had no idea it was so easy to manage my thoughts. She said, and guess what? I'm not even taking sleeping pills anymore. I mean, it's not a lifelong, you know, years-long process of analyzing anything. It's behavioral. As we become aware of our internal behavior and manage our internal system and practice good mental hygiene, we feel differently. It's the most amazing thing. She's teaching a lot of these techniques to her patients now. And, you know, and helping them get out of therapy a lot sooner.
Isn't that wonderful?
It's
so
amazing.
That the therapist was able to actually take these techniques and not only use them on herself, but offer them as tools to her patients. This is terribly exciting work that you're doing. And we want to talk about the Care for the Caregiver series, mm-hmm. which is something that we definitely want all the nurses in the audience to know about, because it is addressing the most important issue, I think, that's really coming up today with the nursing crisis. What we're looking at are, as you know, so many nurses that are burnt out, that are just, you know, tired, they're spent, they're disillusioned, unhappy, they're just not nourished, not only personally but professionally, in many of the environments that they're working in. So let's talk about the nursing situation for just a few minutes, and then we're going to take a break and come back and talk about Care for the Caregivers, which I know you have a lot to share with us about that series. But talk to us first, Eleanor. What is your take on the nursing situation in terms of what nurses are experiencing personally and professionally?
Well, not being a nurse, you know, I'm talking to it really secondhand from what people have told me rather than me experiencing it directly. But just to share that the Care for the Caregivers motto, or, you know, subtext, is creating a culture of caring for health professionals. And my impression, and again, it's anecdotal just from my own experience, is that in general, especially in institutions, nurses don't create or don't experience a culture of caring within their own profession for each other. And there are many separative elements that come into it, including being immersed in a hierarchical system that's set up with, you know, who's on the top and et cetera, et cetera, so that there can be fear and separation generating a reality where when new young nurses come into a ward, I mean, they're coming into a place where people are already overworked and in a sense don't take the time to nurture them and get them up to speed, but expect a lot of them initially, And so they come in already in their initial experiences not feeling nurtured and supported and upheld. And so that sets a pattern up where they then won't turn to their colleagues for support and help because they're not expecting it. And people can be too busy to give it. And there's also, with the hierarchical system, there's divisiveness where I know one nurse said to me, I never go into the coffee room before I go on to my shift because everyone is griping, and by the time I get out of the gripe session, I have no energy left to do my work, which I believe, because griping sessions can de-energize. I mean, it can activate anger, but it's also very de-energizing and very debilitating on the long run in terms of our immune system, our capacity to have joy, our capacity to be in touch with calling and enthusiasm for what we're doing. So creating a culture of caring is absolutely of paramount importance to offset burnout from people that are getting too many assignments to do in too little time with too few, you know, support staff. So given that that's the reality, support internally among each other is even more important than ever before in order to sustain oneself over the long haul and not burn out.
And isn't it amazing that it's not as complicated as we all think it is? You have developed tools. These are very simplistic, very rational, logical, meaningful tools to examine behavior and language and inner dialogue that begins to transform in the moment the environment.
Yes, and really the dynamics can shift very easily if instead of going, oh, there comes the head nurse, she hates me. I mean, that is very difficult to live with through day after day shifts instead of saying, you know, having some compassion with knowing that she's coming from a place of her own pain and is not personally directed at me at all. And coming from that assumption, we can feel much more relaxed and compassionate toward each other than coming from a position of attack, being attacked or attacking, or being in a place of fear. That's very debilitating.
Yes, so we many of us have to move out of the hierarchy, Maslow's hierarchy of a second and third, you know, being in safety and security and all of that kind of reactionary response, and move more into the higher place, which is just what you were talking about, really moving away from ourselves so much and taking a broader look at everyone as really going through the same process and being in the same place. And isn't that a wonderful, wonderful tool to bring to nurses and to bring to the whole healthcare profession? So very excitedly, we are going to come back from break and hopefully hear, we're going to hang on your words about Care for the Caregiver series, because that is, I think, something that's going to change and transform environments profoundly, especially for nurses. So we're going to take a very short break, and we'll be right back to talk about the wonderful work that Eleanor is doing. Don't go away. And welcome back to Celebrating Whole Health. We are talking to Eleanor Kilbrick. And before the break, Eleanor, we said that when we came back, you were going to share with us Care for the Caregiver, the series that you have put together and are bringing around and out into the nursing community across the country. So please begin and tell us all about the work you're doing.
Well, to begin with, Care for the Caregivers, as I said, is creating a culture of caring for health professionals. And we start with a quote actually from Peggy Burkhart on our promotional material, where she says, "In caring for self as a whole being, we bring a more balanced, healing presence to both our life and our care for others, and model self-care for our patients." And that's key, modeling self-care. In other words, we are the message. That's really important. And given what we talked about earlier in the program, modeling self-care can be very challenging at times, given, you know, the situation that people find themselves in. And so we've designed, we have three offerings right now with, you know, variations among them depending on what people need. And the basic one is called The Power of Words: Experience How Language and Thought Patterns Profoundly Affect Health and Well-Being. And that's a one-day workshop that we've gotten accredited by the ANCC. And have done it in a variety of places, including at last year's American Holistic Nurses Association gathering in Scottsdale. We did it as a one-day pre-conference workshop, and it was very powerful. It was really amazing. And what we say in our description is, the purpose of this workshop is to facilitate nurses to recognize their habitual internal dialogue and unconscious belief systems. These patterns may be sabotaging their efforts to attain goals and interfering with their ability to successfully relate with and support colleagues and others. Tools are given to transform thought and word patterns and facilitate shifts in consciousness, energy, and outcomes. So that's what we're doing, is facilitating shifts in consciousness, because everything stems from our consciousness. I mean, that's basic, basic, basic. And lots of times people think of caring for ourselves as caring for the physical, which is really important. I mean, I'm all for massage and acupuncture and all kinds of ways of caring for ourselves. And one of the basic tools then that, or a set of tools that we bring, is caring for our consciousness. Because I can have a wonderful massage and relax my muscles, and then if I'm still having an internal dialogue about being anxious or worried about the future and what's coming up, those muscles will tighten out as soon as I walk out of the massage therapist's office and defeat my purpose of going there in the first place. And so, to me, taking care of our internal dialogue, our internal consciousness, is absolutely of paramount importance. And then we can maintain our physical and emotional well-being much, much easier. And so that is the first basic course that we've been teaching. And the second one that's up now that is called The Language of Leadership, Speak, Think, Act with Consciousness and Power. And that's also a one-day experiential workshop. And in this one, we talk about giving nurses the practical tools to access and express the leader within, and the foundation upon which to step forward and claim it. So we're focusing on the profound connections between words and thoughts and belief system and the expression and embodiment of leadership. And when we're talking about leadership, we are not talking about the hierarchical system and, you know, getting to be a leader and other people are following us. Not at all. We're talking about being our authentic selves. And when we are our authentic selves, we are in our power. When we are in our power, people notice us. and honor us, and it's being in our natural empowered selves at our best, at our most functional best. And that takes, again, being aware and cognizant of what kind of thoughts, belief systems, word patterns we have that can sabotage, can get in the way of being in our authentic empowered selves. And so if we have, and it's very easy to pick it out. I mean, when we just have people go around and just dialogue with us and hear their word patterns, and it may be, I'll give you one example of one person. Actually, this is in a workshop I did where this person was a social worker, and I just had her talk to me for a few minutes in the group. And every other word she said was, it's so hard to raise children. It's so hard to do my work. It's so hard with my patients. And after a few minutes, I stopped her and said, are you aware that you've said the word, it's so hard, about 20 times that I've counted in these 3 minutes of conversation? She hadn't heard one. She hadn't heard one time.
Wow.
It was, I mean,
that's amazing.
She had not heard it. And I just looked at her and I said, have you ever considered introducing ease into your life? And her hunched up shoulders straightened out, her pale face turned pink, she straightened out her posture, and she looked totally different. And she went like, no, I never have considered ease in my life. I mean, not at all. I mean, it wasn't on her screen. And then we entertained, you know, the possibility of things being easy, or entertaining that things can easily be done, and started her having a different conversation. And you wouldn't recognize her. I mean, it was that dramatic. And it sounds simple, and it is simple. It's very profound.
And we don't realize, again, how through our associations at work, at home, our families, our backgrounds, we don't really recognize how these patterns become so embedded in our thinking, in our dialogues with each other, in the way that we have conversation with ourselves. So that's why what you're doing is so, you know, very important for all of us to pay so much more attention to. And, you know, the expression that everything begins with a thought, every action, every creation, every invention, everything that's been ever created or built in the world has started with a thought. And when you think about our lives, you know, we are an entity. It is an entity. And so we're building brick by brick with each word, the house we live in, so to speak.
That's right.
Yes.
That's right. And there's a wonderful book written by a woman called Barbara Haberman Levine called Your Body Believes Every Word You Say.
Oh, yeah. Uh-huh.
It's an excellent book with many, many clinical examples, because she's a therapist, of how our languaging, this isn't about semantics, it's about living our lives and how we do it energetically and what gives us happiness and joy and what really can ultimately create pain and suffering and physical conditions. And her examples are very wonderful for showing, you know, that as we become aware of our habitual patterns and change them, as she did. I mean, you know, we teach that which we need to learn. She had a series of brain tumors that ultimately, you know, got resolved with surgery and with a lot of physiotherapy. And her main word pattern that she picked out among many, but the one that was really a profound one for her was, she used to say, I'm sick and tired of this. I'm sick and tired of this. And
yes,
she got very sick and very tired.
Yes.
It literally, her body translated it into, in her case, brain tumors. It can be anything. It can be, you know, chronic fatigue. I'm not saying that there are no physical correlations that are there as well. At the same time, you know, lo and behold, the mind and body do communicate with each other, their messages, and it goes back and forth and creates the, as you say, house that we live in.
Well, Peggy Huddleston, who is known for her work in Prepare for Surgery, Heal Faster, here in the New England area, her work is throughout all of the hospitals, which is a program that deals with preparing the doctor, the anesthesiologist, the people that are surrounding you prior to going into surgery, to be mindful of the dialogue and the words, when the doctor is operating on you, they're not saying things that your unconscious mind is picking up and going out and listening to, like, gee, this looks really bad, or I don't think this one's going to make it, or whatever.
With my husband too, who had extensive surgery because of a car accident years ago, and he, you know, they had to revive him. I mean, he died a few times. He's around, he's okay now, but he remembered the dialogue of the surgeon.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And it was devastating. It made his healing process much longer. And so learning from that experience, he's had different surgeries since then. He works with the doctor and the anesthesiologist to tell him what he'd like in surgery. And when the last time it happened, he was speaking to this wonderful, wonderful Chinese anesthesiologist and said, you know, when you put me under, can you keep patting my head and telling me it's going to be all right, it's okay, you're doing well? And he did it. And my husband got through surgery very quickly, very well, and healed well. And he spoke to the anesthesiologist afterwards, who said, I did it. And now this transformed that man's life.
Yes, exactly. Well, I do want to just mention Peggy Huddleston's work, which I know that you're familiar with. And the work that she has done really brings to point the work that you're doing by saying, when we speak words, they have such power, not only to each other, but to ourselves, and that they can heal or they can kill. And isn't that incredible, you know, that words can do that?
Oh, words can harm and words can heal.
Yes.
It happens all the time. And it's very important to know that, because many times people, for instance, have sarcasm in their humor. That's anger. That's hostile.
Yes.
And if people say, isn't this funny? No, it isn't. It's hostile. And I've called people on that because it's damaging to people. And so it's important also to watch what we call humor, and see if it's really a hostility or humor. There's a genuine difference, and everyone feels it. It's important to acknowledge it and to get into genuine joy, not sarcasm that masquerades as humor.
Well, then that we're in a lot of trouble as a culture, aren't we? Because so much of what we listen to, whether it's rap music or commercials or just the, you know, the daily news, the way that words are used, isn't it something that, you know, it's so subtle, we're not really paying attention, but the effect that it has on us individually and culturally, you can step back and watch it, and I'm sure you've done that many times, you know, watch the effects of these, you know, very broad environmental dialogues that are going on.
Well, a very, very basic one. I don't know if you're familiar with the research that has been done and is being done in Japan on the on water. There are groups of scientists who have photographed the crystalline structure of water molecules under very different conditions. So, for instance, this is really amazing. Even if you write the word love on the test tube of water and keep it there for a while and then photograph with electron microscope the crystalline structure of the molecule, it'll be pristine and beautiful. And if you write the word hate, it'll look muddy, murky, and change color. If you have heavy metal or rap music, it'll change the crystalline structure of the water. If you have Beethoven or Bach, it'll be pristine and beautiful. I mean, and we're made up of water primarily. So they're showing at the molecular level that molecules of water change their configuration depending on the emotional energetics of words, of vibrations like music and so on basic molecular structure.
Isn't that wonderful? It really is wonderful because what it says is there is such perfection and order to creation that everything is connected to everything, that all of the things that you're talking about and so many people are talking about is that we need to become aware. We need to wake up and become aware of the fact that the things that we've heard through our own, you know, backgrounds, our spiritual backgrounds or our religious teachings, that much of this wisdom, you know, be careful of what you think, you know, as a man thinks, so he grows and all
That's
this
right.
other stuff. All of this wisdom that is very ancient, although they didn't have the research and they didn't have the trial studies, what they knew was true because they observed how life unfolds.
Yeah, I mean, that which you pay attention to, that you shall become. So what are you paying attention to? Watch what you're focusing on, because you'll become more of an embodiment of that as you focus on it. So be aware of what you're focused on.
And isn't that something that we can leave as a message, you know, to each other? I like to think about leaving notes on the pillow. Don't you think we need to remind ourselves and each other every day, Eleanor?
Constantly. Yeah.
And how do you do that? Like, what do you use as reminders for yourself and for those around you?
Well, my reminder is that I've made a promise to myself, actually a vow, to be responsible for every thought that I speak and every word that I speak and every thought in my mind. Now, you know, I'm not 100% on it all the time, but that I renew every day, and so that keeps me aware and awake and present, because I'm always thinking or talking. I mean, our mind is always active, and so it keeps me here and present, and I find it a tremendously valuable tool for keeping awake.
Well, and that, I think, is the operative word, isn't it? For us to be awake to the moment, awake to ourselves, awake to those around us.
Awake to what we create moment by moment by moment with our thoughts and words as well as our actions.
It's wonderful. You're not going to believe this. We are having to take another break, and when we come back, we'll be in our last segment. So it would be just terribly important for you to talk about the work you're doing with the Florence Nightingale Initiative, and if you would, you know, share that with us, especially what the plans are for 2010, which is a very ambitious project, but a really wonderful bunch of work. So we're going to take a break. We'll be right back. Don't go away. And we're back from our break. We're talking to Eleanor Kilbrick. Eleanor, talk to us.
Well, I just wanted to complete talking about the Care for the Caregivers program that has it within it, you know, language and the power that we convey and so on, with a few helpful examples that people that are listening to this program can then use in their lives. One of them is to monitor repetition so that, just like that woman didn't hear it so hard, start to become aware of your word patterns, and then without judging them as good or bad, just become aware and then make new language choices that may be more helpful to you in terms of getting through your day and ultimately getting through your life. Examine the use of the word but, for instance. For instance, if I say to you, Georgiana, I like you, Georgiana, but, you know, there's a drop in energy because but negates what went on just a moment ago. Instead, even if grammatically sometimes it seems a little odd, use the word and. I like you, Georgiana, and you have a wonderful, wonderful program at your school. I mean, you'll feel it in your emotional body, Georgiana. When I say I like you, but, don't you feel a little different in your emotional body?
Oh, sure, yeah.
Than if I say I like you and etc. Now, this is a very small change, and it's a very important one. So those would be like two examples out of a number that I can give to just ask those of you who are listening to be aware of your thoughts. And if you find your thoughts are into excessive worry, for instance, there's a wonderful woman, Corrie Ten Boom, who actually died in the Holocaust. And what she said is, worry does not empty tomorrow of its sorrows. It empties today of its strength.
Wow.
It's important to remember that. Worry does not empty tomorrow of its sorrows. It empties today of its strength. So I'll leave it at that. But those can be some things just to keep on the front burner and be mindful of, because that can help you shift and really have more ease in your life and more happiness. And as you are embodying more happiness and feel it, then that's the message that you bring to the patient when you walk in their room. And that immediately uplifts them and is really therapeutic for them, in addition to all the other interventions that you bring.
Well, yes, and isn't that what we're really looking at in this, you know, in this decade? We're looking at how we are with one another, how we are with ourselves, and how we relate and be with one another. So that's such a helpful and wonderful perspective, Eleanor. But you must be, but...
You're quick, Georgiana.
And,
you're a good student.
And you must speak about the Nightingale Initiative.
Yeah, we have started, a number of us are launching a major initiative called the Nightingale Initiative for Global Health. And using this initiative to mobilize grassroots participation with nurses all over the world, creating community with nurses all over the world, so that nurses feel more that the reality of being global citizens, as well as living in certain countries and neighborhoods and in certain families and so on, and launching a drive that will, or a momentum that will result in a UN declaration of the International Year of the Nurse in 2010, which is the anniversary of Florence Nightingale's death. Then we will proceed after that with 10 years of projects, sharing approaches that already work and projects that are already working around the world initiated by nurses, projects that are being launched and started in terms of caring in local communities and caring on a global level for 10 years, culminating in another major international celebration in 2020 on the bicentennial of Nightingale's birth. So basically, it's an empowering movement that will be supported by these kind of workshops, trainings, launching of projects, different initiatives that are already in place and that can spread through a network of nurses all over the world to help our sisters and brothers wherever they are in the work that they're doing.
What an ambitious and extraordinary project. Now,
well, we have a very strong team of people that have a lot of international experience, and we're really open to people certainly joining us in many ways. And we also have designed a declaration that we will be spreading and disseminating widely for nurses to sign, first of all, taking responsibility for their own health, the health of their community, and the health of the world, and having a massive amount of signatures to then bring to the UN in support of declaring 2010 the International Year of the Nurse.
Isn't that a treat? I mean, that's going to be, I think, a wonderful gift to the profession of nursing, as well as change and transform the view of nursing, the experience of nursing, the whole concept of what, as a nurse, it's all about for the people who are, you know, privileged enough to be in the profession, as well as for the patients who have the good fortune to have good and competent nursing.
Well, without nursing, there's no caregiving system. I mean, it's just, it's really important and paramount important in terms of addressing so many of the global crises now to uplift, uphold, support nurses everywhere, because they're the backbone of the whole system.
Absolutely. And so the good news is, I think, that the crisis that we're looking at, which has been around for a number of years now, has brought with it a wonderful gift, and that is action to change the very root problems of, you know, what has caused the nursing crisis. That is a return, going back to the basic principles and the basic underlying intentionality and the soul of nursing, which, of course, came out of Florence Nightingale. So this is, it's wonderful to hear this, and I'm sure that people listening are excited and want to know more, which brings up the question, how can they get in touch with you, and how can they know more about this wonderful work?
Well, they can get in touch with me, and they can call me if they want, and I can give my phone number, which is 703-521-1614 in Arlington, Virginia. We have, and they can personally email me, or email our, we're changing our email address fairly soon, but they can do it to me and I can pass it along, which is Rolph Kibrick, R-O-L-P-H-K-I-B-R-I-C-K, Rolph Kibrick at mindspring.com. And also certainly go to our site. We have a website up, which is www.florencenightingale2010.net. That would, in fact, that would be the best way to go in, and then you can connect with Diva, you can connect with me, and so on through that site.
And we will put that information up on the archives page with all the contact information for you as well. I want to just say thank you, not only for being on the show, but on behalf of all of us who are working in healthcare, most especially the nurses and people who are looking to change the quality and the care that is today our American healthcare system. We know that it's time to return to the beginning, to return to the essence of what caring is all about. And the work that you're doing is clearly going to enhance, change, and transform that. So on behalf of all of us, thank you, and thank you for the time you've taken. I know how you are terribly busy these days, and you've got so much on your plate, and it's wonderful that you know, we've had a chance to speak with you. And is there anything at the last minute you would like to tell us about? I know you've got something coming up pretty soon. There's something that's coming up pretty soon down in Washington, yes?
Yes, there's a Florence Nightingale service Sunday, May the 9th at 3:30 p.m. at the Washington National Cathedral here in Washington, D.C. That is an amazing event. We had the inaugural event in 2001, and this is the second Nightingale service, and it honors nurses as they continue to do Nightingale's mission of caring and healing.
Well, that is an open invitation, I'm sure, to everyone. And again, thank you for that, for your work, for your time. And we wish you all the best of luck on our behalf and on behalf of the world to continue doing what you're doing, Eleanor.